Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the show today. Well, whether we actually live it or not, we all know intellectually that we are what we eat. And like I said, whether we practice that every day or not is a whole other thing. But there are some folks out there, some groups of people for whom nutrition actually affects the way they can behave. And we'll be looking at that today. My guest has dedicated her working life to understanding how nutrition and environmental toxins impact the brain and the body's biochemistry, and specifically how environmental toxins, genetics, and biochemistry are implicated in what she calls newly epidemic disorders in children. Today, we're taking a holistic look at nutrition intervention for one of those epidemic disorders. We're talking about nutrition intervention for autism spectrum disorder. My guest is Julie Matthews. She's a certified nutritionist and co-founder of Healthful Living. Julie's been a DAN practitioner for 6 years, and we'll explain that in just a moment. And her latest book is the culmination of 7 years of research and study on this very topic. Her book is called Nourishing Hope, Nutrition Intervention for Autism Spectrum Disorder. Julie, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased to have you here because when I was doing my research, I realized you're probably way out there leading the field in this. And it's good to have such an expert on the show. I mentioned during the intro that you're a DAN practitioner. So let's get that out of the way, first of all. What does that mean, DAN?
Sure. DAN stands for Defeat Autism Now. And it is one of the groups out there that's really spearheading a lot of the connection between the biochemistry of the body and how it affects autism and affects the brain. So there are everything from MDs to PhDs, nutrition consultants, chiropractors, all sorts of people that are considered DAN practitioners. And they sort of follow a similar philosophy.
Okay. And why did you choose this as your specialty?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I don't have a child with autism. I actually got involved because I was just curious early on in my nutrition studies about the link between all the junk food we feed our kids and what kind of a role that might be playing on any of the childhood disorders. And when I learned about autism and that there actually was something you could do about it, which was so contrary to everything else I'd ever heard and read, that I was so interested and fascinated that I started studying it pretty much full-time for many years.
Mm. And your whole philosophy with your company, Healthful Living, is to help people, all kinds of people really, just heal themselves through nutrition. Is that right?
Yes, it's true. You know, we look at all different areas of the person and the body, but nutrition, of course, being one of the foundational pieces of that, and most specifically, it having a really big impact with autism.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about autism spectrum disorder and what that actually means. I know very little about it, and you say in the book that it's reached epidemic proportions. So let's talk about that.
Yes, the rate of autism has increased from 1 in 10,000 about 12, 15 years ago to now 1 in every 150 children.
So say that again, 1 in 10,000?
Went from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 150.
Wow, in 10 years?
Yes. In about 15 years or something like that, yeah. It is really, really an epidemic. It is skyrocketed. It was almost unheard of before.
Yeah. Now, the obvious question, and I asked this on another show I did on bipolar disorder last week, because that's being diagnosed more, is are we getting better at diagnosing the disorder, and is that why we're finding it? But according to research in the book, the diagnostic process now is still the same as it was 10 years ago. Is that correct?
As far as I know, since that's not an area I deal with directly, but from what I understand, it has been just observation of a practitioner looking at certain, you know, behavioral and other types of markers. So it's a very subjective diagnosis, and it is the same, more or less the similar criteria that it's been for a while.
Mm. So let's look at autism spectrum disorder. And I'm assuming the spectrum means that there's a wide range of behaviors in this, from severe to less severe.
Correct.
So what does it mean? Tell me what it means. What's going on with the kids?
Sure. So there's usually a range of communication, social, and behavioral manifestations, I suppose you could say. So behaviors that aren't what we don't typically see in what we call neurotypical children, like not being able to make direct eye contact, lining toys up in lines instead of playing with them, hand flapping, staring at lights or door hinges, not playing, not having imaginative to play with others, and then a wide range of communication. So some can communicate just fine. Others don't have any language.
Mm. And does it affect boys more than girls, girls more than boys?
It affects boys 4 to 1. And so it's actually, the statistic is, while it's 150 children, it's 1 in every 94 boys.
And do we know why?
Well, those of us that have been actually really looking and studying have really come to a conclusion that it's a combination of particular genetic predispositions that have been set up over time, combined with the large number of environmental assaults that we have today. So just about, I think, 10 years ago, there were only 10 vaccines. There's now 33 vaccines. And so, you know, I'm not certainly blaming it all on that, but that's certainly something to look at. The toxins that are in them, the toxins now in our air, the pesticides, plastics, these things are a lot more than they were, you know, 50 years ago or even 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and we've just had this latest scare this last 2 or 3, 4 weeks about plastics again in general. And I know you mentioned that in your book. But I want to ask you, is nutrition for autism, kids with autism, how significantly different is it from good nutrition that we would want to give our kids without autism?
Well, there's certain things that are going to be the same. So we want to get them the best nutrition as possible. So we want to get them the good fatty acids like the fish oils and the good quality fats versus the trans fats. We want to get them vegetables and fruits and whole foods rather than processed foods. So maximizing nutrition is something that's the same for everybody. But in terms of, there are special sort of autism diets, certain foods that children with autism can't process that other children can, like wheat and dairy and artificial ingredients and things like that. So those are the things that we often focus on with autism.
Mm. You talk, Julie, about the brain being downstream of the body. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that, and why is it important to autism and diet?
So people often think of autism as a, quote, psychiatric condition, that sort of it's this kind of mysterious brain disorder. We don't know where it starts. We don't know where it ends. We just kind of keep it all up. You know, it's a brain thing. But really, we know that the brain is signaled from neurotransmitters and nutrients and things that we get from the body. And so the health of the body and the detoxification and the digestive systems and the immune system are all going to play into what happens in the brain later on. So autism is actually what we would consider a whole body disorder, that when this body and biochemistry isn't in balance, it causes impact on the brain and the behaviors we see.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that boys are 4 times more likely to have autism than girls. What is specifically different about boys? What is it going on in their chromosomes? I mean, what's the difference there?
Sure. And let me just say one more thing, because you asked the second part to that first question that I forgot to comment on, which was when you see this, when you understand autism as a whole body disorder, how is that different? Well, now it's enormously different, because now we have hope. Before, the diagnosis was, there's no cure, there's nothing we can do, we don't understand it, get some behavioral therapy and some speech therapy, and, you know, maybe a medication if you have something specific that we can help with. Otherwise, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. This is very different than understanding that autism has nutrient deficiencies, digestive disturbances involved, immune system overactivity, all these things that we can now use foods and supplementation to target by removing the problematic things that stress the system and adding the good things to the system. So that, I think, is a huge key point to all of this.
Definitely, sounds it. Now, so what is going on with boys then? What's the difference there?
Sure. We still need a lot of study into this. We don't know all of the reasons on all of the things going on yet. However, there's a few things that just stand out off the top of our heads. One is that estrogen has antioxidant capability, so it is a protective mechanism, whereas testosterone is actually known in studies to make things like mercury and some of those toxins actually more toxic to boys. So that's just one thing. Also, the plastics have estrogen-like compounds in them, and we don't know if that plays a different role in it for boys than it does for girls. So there is definitely something going on, though, because there's a very large skewing to boys.
Mm. You talk about epigenetics in the book, and we actually did a whole show on epigenetics last year, but how does that relate to autism?
Yes, so epigenetics is basically the looking at the study of genetics in terms of how quickly we can sort of turn on and off genes to respond to our environment versus the probably more time-consuming evolutionary process of changing our DNA sequence. So epigenetics allows us to study what's happening on this genetic level that we have influence over. And interestingly, two of the things that seem to influence this type of genetic response, we often thought of genetics as a fixed system. And this basically explains that it's not fixed. And two things that influence it are toxins that can negatively influence it and, I think, set people up for more further damage from the toxins later, and nutritional status. So that it becomes interesting to see that, you know, often we look at autism as, oh, it's a genetic issue, so let's find that one gene and that one cure. But this shows that epigenetics or that other types of genes could be at play here, and how can we maybe influence the body in areas that we don't know too much about yet.
Right. And you just mentioned mercury and toxicity there. You say in the book, a doctor quotes in the book, mercury may well pull the trigger for autism, but it's the environmental toxins that load the gun. So let's take a closer look at, you know, when we're exposed to mercury, we all know that's bad for us. We've heard enough about it. But what other things do we need to avoid in the way of heavy metals?
Well, because children with autism have poor detoxification often to begin with, they're more susceptible to toxins than we are. So all of the old lead-based paints around houses that can be sloughing off and causing lead toxicity, all of the toys from China with lead, all of the vinyl lunch boxes that had higher lead levels, the air, things like, of course, fish and vaccinations and all these things that might have mercury in them, flame retardants used in infant sleepwear and in bedding and things can be problematic. So you start adding up all of these small little toxic exposures that you and I would hopefully come in contact with at a slow enough basis. We might be able to process some of them. But for children and babies that weigh a fraction of what we do and don't have the detoxification systems totally set up and are bombarded by a lot more because some of these toxins are injected directly into them with, you know, vaccinations and various other things, that they can be far more impacted when your detoxification system on top of it is a little bit more sluggish than the average child. That can just put you over the edge.
Okay, and you talk about, is it chelation or shellation?
Chelation.
Chelation in the book. You talk about a chelating agent that's added to the body and can pull metals from where they've settled. Tell us how that works, how it's used, how it works, why it's important.
Sure. This is something that I don't do. I, as a nutrition consultant, I focus more on the foods and some good nutrient supplementation. But this is, diet is the most effective therapy, according to parents, with the exception of chelation. So chelation has been found by a lot of parents to be very helpful, and it's basically a process that you work with a doctor to remove the heavy metals from the body. And parents report in surveys and things that were done with the Autism Research Institute that it's been very helpful, because if you have all these toxins in your system, you can actually often, if you can get the toxins out of the system, you can kind of reverse some of the damage, maybe not all, but you know, you can have an impact, like some parents are saying.
Interesting. And that must be done with a doctor, obviously, who knows what enough about this to help us through it.
Yeah, chelation is one of those things that, you know, if we know we have toxins, our first inclination is get them out as fast as we can. But you need a qualified person, because you can actually stir up more toxins and create more damage than if you just leave them where they are sometimes. So you want to get someone that's really skilled and know and has done this with had enough experience that they know, you know, what agents are safe and how to do them.
Okay. And so that if we go to a doctor, those are the kind of questions we want to ask, is how much experience you've had, how does this work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I would say that if you go to your standard medical doctor, they probably, most of them, don't do chelation unless they see that you have something that they're familiar with, like a high lead level or something. You know, and a lot of them don't really do a lot of chelation. So you would mostly be seeking out somebody specializing in autism treatments, like a DAN physician. But again, even within that, you really want to ask parents for a referral, or really do your homework and ask some good questions.
Sure. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to look at some nutritional strategies that you recommend. And I know that you don't recommend a particular diet. My guest is Julie Matthews. She's a certified nutritionist, and she calls herself a diet synthesizer. Her book is Nourishing Hope, Nutrition Intervention for Autism Spectrum Disorder. And we'll be right back with you in just a couple of minutes.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
How many times have you said, I'll never be able to do this, or I just can't do it anymore? Even the most creative of us run out of creative juice and fresh ideas. Well, get ready to get stimulated. And join Vicki St. Clair on Monday, April 28th at noon for Conversations Live. Explore 5 habits to launch you on an exciting journey of personal discovery. Learn how to build creative confidence and fire your creative energy. Vicki's joined by creative strategists, speakers, and authors Janine McGlade and Andrew Peck, co-creators of Noves Inc., a New York-based consulting and education firm that helps companies stimulate breakthrough ideas. That's Monday, April 28th at noon, with Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, everyone. I'm Buzz.
And I'm Robin, reminding you to catch The Living Life Show Thursdays at 2 p.m. right here on KKNW.
The Living Life Show is your weekly guide to living life better both at home and away.
Each week, we bring you interesting guests and industry experts who share their tips for your home and your vacations.
We even have some great recipes for you to try, and you can even see us make them on our website.
You bet. So be sure to listen Thursday at 2 p.m. to The Living Life Show right here on KKNW.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my special guest today is Julie Matthews. She's a certified nutritionist and calls herself a diet synthesizer. She specializes in autism spectrum disorder and how the diet can really help kids with autism. So, Julie, I wanted to look at some nutritional strategies in this segment.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to start out by asking you, you mentioned wheat and dairy already, but what happens specifically when kids eat wheat or dairy?
Mm. Good question. Well, there's a variety of negative reactions you can get. They can be very inflammatory to the gut, which can set up all sorts of digestive disturbances and pain and different behaviors associated with that. But also, there's a large number of children with autism that create opiates from these. So it would be like you and I being on morphine, you know, and we'd be foggy thinking and spacey and not being able to pay attention well, maybe even have some constipation or digestive problems, which is common. So that's just a couple of the ways that wheat and dairy can have a problem. And when we ask parents, they say that when they take these foods out, sometimes they see some of the most dramatic benefits from the removing of these two foods. They say anything from digestive disturbances going away to language improvements and better attention and behavior and all sorts of things. So this has been a dietary intervention that's gotten fairly popular and thousands of parents have been using it.
That is really amazing. Now, I want to just mention you have a ton of information in the book here on various different diets, yet you don't recommend one. I'm assuming that's because, you know, one size does not fit all.
Exactly. So one of the things I sometimes hear is, well, I tried the diet, quote, the diet, you know, that there's some approved the diet. I've tried the diet before and it didn't work for my child, so therefore a diet doesn't help and then they don't do anything. Well, what I've found is if you don't follow the diet very strictly or if you substitute, let's say, wheat for corn, which could also be a problem for someone else, or if you need a different type of diet that maybe focuses on a different area, then you sort of, if you don't realize that and you just try kind of give the basic GFCF, the gluten-free, casein-free diet, like a half try, then you won't see any, you know, beneficial results. So I'd like to let people know that, yes, there are some step-by-step things that you can do, and I lay them out in my book, but I also like to give people an idea of what other diets are out there that other parents have gotten results from in addition to the gluten and casein-free diet.
Okay. So let's say I have a child with autism and I have never really, you know, looked at the diet beyond making sure they get fruit and vegetables and all that stuff. Where do I start?
First thing to do is to remove the artificial ingredients. This is going to help everybody. If you have a child with, maybe you have one child with autism, but your other child has asthma, this removing the artificial ingredients helps. It helps with the other sibling that might have ADHD. It helps with dad that might have migraines. It helps with mom that might be, getting rashes or something like that. So removing these artificial colors, the artificial flavors, the preservatives, the MSG ingredients, not just MSG itself, but if you Google search hidden MSG ingredients, you'll find all sorts of other names come up. These are the first things that any family will want to do in diet.
Okay. And so once we've removed all of those, what's the next step? And I know it's going to vary for different people.
It's a good question. So I see two parts to diet just in general. One is removing all the offending stuff, and that might be all the artificial things. It might be wheat, it might be dairy, it might be corn. So that's step one. And then step two is going to be adding in the good nutrition. So in addition to removing the artificial ingredients, I usually recommend most people try a gluten and casein-free trial. Give it 3 to 6 months of really doing the diet 100%. Some people notice pretty profound things within a few days. Sometimes it takes people a little bit longer, but this diet is often a really good diet that a lot of people often start with after they kind of do some of the basics of taking out the toxic stuff.
Okay, now I want to talk about dairy because you said this is something that a lot of kids can be allergic to, but I also saw in there something on raw dairy, and you had a slightly different take on raw dairy. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
Yes, I'm curious. Do you have raw dairy in your state? I think you do, actually, now that I think about it.
Eric's nodding his head, so
yes.
I'm going to say
yes. So in certain states, raw dairy is legal, like in California and Washington, and then in other states, it's not legal, or there's varying degrees of legality depending on how you get it or if you have a cow share or different things. So the thing about raw dairy is that it is unpasteurized, so while there come some concerns associated with that that we can certainly talk about, there's actually a lot of benefits that nobody ever talks about. They just get stuck at the risks and they never get to the benefits. So if you have a true casein sensitivity, which is the protein that's found in animal products, you are not going to be able to handle any dairy, even if it is raw dairy. However, there is a subset of children that sometimes do a different diet, like the diet called the specific carbohydrate diet, and they just know that they don't seem to have a negative reaction to dairy. Some of them will try raw dairy because of it's much easier to digest. The protein molecule is in its, you know, pristine, natural form without any alteration and all those types of things that some people can handle raw dairy that it can't handle pasteurized. But, of course, people want to just be careful that you don't want to buy just any old raw dairy. You need to buy it from someone that you've done a lot of good research on. You want to make sure that they take care of their cows really well because these types of farms specifically focus on raising milk for raw use. So they treat their animals in a much more healthy way, and they don't have most of the pathogens that other types of dairy farms might have.
Okay, so basically it's up to us if we choose to go that way. I mean, you know, because there are, as you said, differing opinions on that, but it's all a case of trial and error, really, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And so individual parents, it's kind of like everything. Individual parents need to look at the benefits and the risks and kind of figure out what seems to make the most sense for their child.
Mm. I also wanted to talk about medicinal mushrooms, because you mentioned those in the book, and I know many holistic practitioners say stay away from them. But you say they create many substances that defend us against disease.
Right. A lot of practitioners and holistic practitioners avoid mushrooms, and I would definitely agree that these standard button mushrooms, culinary mushrooms, are things that I don't typically add to a diet. However, medicinal mushrooms are different. There's only one medicinal mushroom that's a culinary mushroom, and that's shiitake. All the rest of the medicinal mushrooms only come in supplement form because they're too woody or they don't cook well. So when I'm thinking of medicinal mushrooms, I'm thinking of shiitake, reishi, maitake. These are very specific mushrooms that actually we have a very similar, believe it or not, our immune system is, and our DNA is closer to a mushroom than it is to a plant.
Wow.
And so we actually create a lot of anti-or immune system substances that really are helpful to us because we have similar immune systems and it benefits them.
Interesting. Now, with candida overgrowth, I know this is a problem for many, many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of the symptoms of candida overgrowth. How do we know if that's our problem?
Yes. So candida often will manifest with digestive challenges since it's a yeast overgrowth in the gut. Then often the yeast will start fermenting the sugars and the carbohydrates and create gas or bloating, diarrhea or constipation. Those types of things are often fairly common. But also things like spacey thinking and kind of some kids with autism will get this like maniacal laughter, almost like a mad scientist, or laughing in the middle of the night for basically no reason. Those are all, or acting like they're drunk, because how do we make beer? We make it from yeast and carbohydrates.
Right,
So these are some of the common symptoms we see. And actually, yeast is very prevalent with autism, because they often have a weaker immune system and they often have more ear infections and are given more antibiotics. And when those antibiotics kill the bad bacteria, they also kill the good bacteria that's competition against the yeast. So if you're a woman and you've ever taken antibiotics and you get a yeast infection, you kind of understand that cycle and how that can perpetuate yeast for some of these children.
Yeah, and then that would weaken their immune system even more, wouldn't it?
Correct.
Right. So I know that cleaning up the gut, as we say, can be a very delicate process because we can just as easily kill the good bacteria as the bad bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
How do we go about if we have if we're dealing specifically with a child with autism, how do we go about dealing with this?
Well, just in general, children with autism are pretty sensitive, so it's often good to start really slow with things and often try to do products or substances that are, you know, commonly used and have been discussed by parents to have pretty good success ratings. So it's going to depend, you know, since I do natural remedies, I work more with food and supplements. So starving out the yeast by getting rid of the sugar in the diet so we're not feeding the yeast. There are some diets that will take out all the complex starches like potatoes and rice and that kind of thing. So there's a variety of different dietary methods that someone might employ to start starving out the yeast. And then you can look at adding good fermented foods in that have that good live bacteria, or some probiotic supplements that can give you that live bacteria. And then also they have special supplements that are used particularly for killing off yeast overgrowth. And so those are also something someone can look into if they wanted to. Coconut oil, raw coconut oil, has caprylic acid, which is great at killing off yeast. So you can use a variety of different foods and supplements to support candida. And also there are medications that if you wanted to go to your doctor, they would be able to talk to you about those as well.
Okay. And I want to talk a little bit about, look at the biochemistry. You say that this seems complex, and it does sound complex, but you also say it's very important. You talk about the biochemistry of methylation, transsulfuration, and sulfation. Tell us what that means and why it's so important.
Sure. This is really an illustration of what we know so far, and it's showing us that there's, number one, a lot that we do know and a lot we can positively influence, and also a lot we don't know and more things we might find out if we actually allocate good money to actually studying this as opposed to villainizing certain things and, getting other things off scot-free. So
sure.
Methylation is a biochemical process that does things like methylate DNA, which is part of that epigenetics conversation. So children with autism often have poor methylation. So things like that, methylating and activating neurotransmitters in the brain, melatonin to help people sleep, these are often things that are deficient when this pathway is not working well. And then that goes to a process, you need that working well in order to get to that second process called transsulfuration. And this is work done by Dr. Jill James, and she's found some amazing research that these children don't have the bottom line substance that comes out of that pathway is called glutathione. And that's so important for fighting viruses properly and getting your immune system and your inflammation process in the right balance, having your antioxidant function, detoxification, the gut barrier. These are all things done by glutathione. And when that's not working well, you see a lot of the challenges we see in these kids. And so, and then there's a final process called sulfation, which deals with certain substances in foods that we may choose to eliminate or not based on how well someone is doing that process, that third part of the process. So I guess the importance of this is just to know that when people say there is no science behind it, there is a lot of interesting science and helpful science to see how these systems that we've seen to be low in autism actually affect the biochemistry and make a good understanding of how these are affecting the brain. And then we can influence them once we understand what's going on.
Yeah, you do. You talk about this a lot in the book. I mean, there's a lot of science you share in the book. I was really quite staggered, actually. One of the things that I've seen with, I used to have a cousin, I say used to because he did pass away of heart disease, nothing to related with autism, but I had a cousin who would only eat one kind of food, and that was potatoes. How do you work with parents and their kids and nutritionists to get them to integrate other foods into their diet?
Yes, this. I'm glad you brought that up because there's a lot of parents probably listening that think, oh, well, and because I hear this every day, there's no way I can do the gluten-free and casein-free diet because the only thing my child eats are wheat and dairy products like pizza, macaroni and cheese, grilled cheese, bread, and milk.
Right,
And I want parents to understand that part of that picky eating is actually due to those opiates. And it's literally an addiction to the chemicals in the food that's causing them to not eat any vegetables and not eat anything besides those particular foods that they're eating. And so when you have any child that is will only eat certain foods, I would assume there's something wrong with that food that they can't process. So you'd have to look and see what it might be and start to, become your own detective on some of these things. But really looking into that can help parents firstly understand what's going on and how they might want to proceed with diet, and then just give them hope that once you actually remove those addictive foods, the diet will often open up and expand. And you want to just, so you want to take those things out first, but you also want to try to, you know, you need some good substitutes. So there's lots of good gluten and casein-free substitutes, gluten-free pastas and gluten-free breads and things like that that we can do in their place. Gluten-free breads aren't the most delicious, but gluten-free pasta, you can't tell the difference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can just kind of see what substitutes you can make for your child and really go from there. And really, little by little, you can overcome the picky eating issue.
Just got to be consistent, right?
You have to be consistent.
Persistent.
Yes, and understand why they're so limited and do your best to work within their texture needs and their flavor needs and all of that to help come up with some good options.
Mm. I've also read many times in different studies that food sensitivity can be caused and definitely inflamed by eating the same foods over and over. Is that something you agree with?
Yes, yes, especially and particularly if your gut is not functioning well, your gut permeability, what we call leaky gut, when you're not able to break down the foods and they leak into the bloodstream, then the body doesn't recognize them and it starts creating these allergic or what we call food sensitivity responses. And that's really one of the things that is often happening with the wheat and dairy. But it also happens with soy and corn. It can happen with citrus and a variety of other different foods as well.
How does it actually leak into the bloodstream? It sounds gross, leaky gut. I mean, it really does. But I know it's an issue for many people. And so how does it actually leach into the bloodstream?
Yeah. So normally what would happen is that we would break down, let's say, a bagel with let's just put butter on there. We're going to break it down to all its small little amino acids and fatty acids and break it down to small enough components that just those, let's say, amino acids are going to be the protein parts are going to leak into the bloodstream. And the immune system then recognizes them as something it's well aware of and lets them pass and go to the liver and do their thing. But when you don't have the good digestive capacity, you can't break those long protein chains down into the little amino acids. So instead, it stays in these long protein chains. These long protein chains can be very inflammatory, especially when these proteins can be inflammatory to the gut, and then we don't digest well. And then we start, with that along with candida can create these, what do I want to say, junctions that are supposed to be tight can make them, quote, leaky. And so these large proteins get into the bloodstream. And then the immune system isn't expecting them and doesn't recognize them. So it says, ooh, this protein must be a foreign protein, like a virus or something. And so then the immune system starts to create a negative reaction every time you eat it.
So now we know. All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Julie Matthews. Her book is called Nourishing Hope, Nutrition Intervention for Autism Spectrum Disorder. Please stay with us.
Looking for unconditional love? An exercise buddy or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy-to-understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with Julie Matthews. Her book is Nourishing Hope, Nutrition Intervention for Autism Spectrum Disorder. And Julie, let's go ahead and give out your website, because I understand people can only buy the book right now from your website.
Yeah, my website is nourishinghope.com, and it will, you know, eventually the book will be other places, but right now that's the best place to get it. And there's also a free presentation on there, a video that I did, and a whole bunch of other just really good background information if people want to get more detail. So it's nourishinghope.com.
Okay, very good. And we'll give that out again before the end of the show today. What do you think is the most common misconception about autism? I know you've worked with it a long time. What's the most common misconception?
I would say that autism is not treatable, and that children with autism don't recover. You know, if you ask the mainstream, it's pretty much a lifelong illness, and there's nothing that you can do, and you're sort of stuck with it for life. And yeah, I've even heard stories of parents who have recovered their children and gone back to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician or the new one says, oh, they must have been misdiagnosed. They've even had gone back to the same doctor and said, who diagnosed your child? They misdiagnosed them. And because they can't see the possibility that children can actually recover and that there's actually something that can be done, because many of them don't understand it well enough. None of us understand it well enough. We need to do tons more research, but we do see that there's a lot that you can do, and I just really want people to know that.
And some people function very well as adults, and you know, my cousin did. I mean, he raised a family before he died, but is that just part of the spectrum? You know, he's maybe on the lower end, because as a child, he was very non-communicative.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, like anything, the people can progress in different ways, and depending, there's such a wide range of autisms that, you know, if you're high functioning versus low functioning, can make a difference kind of on how somebody might change over time. I wouldn't say that you outgrow autism, but if you had a more mild form or you learn certain skills, you can cope very well and do just fine.
Mm. We haven't talked about supplements yet. Do you recommend supplements to help?
I do. You know, I think that food is the first and most important thing, and poor food intake will not take the place of it. I mean, can you think if you were consuming morphine every day, it wouldn't really matter if you were taking a little vitamin C or not. So,
right,
you know, that's just a reason. First, you want to do diet, and yes, when you take the dairy out of the diet, you want to add calcium in, and you want to make sure they get all the nutrients, because they have a lot of nutrient deficiencies. So often people will look at B6 and magnesium, which have had many good studies done on for children with autism, and a variety of different vitamins and minerals, as well as the fatty acids like the fish oils that we hear so much about, their help with neurological conditions like depression and ADHD and things. So fish oils are wonderful. And then looking at other digestive support, things like the good bacteria, the probiotics that you can get in supplement form, as well as and digestive enzymes and things like that. So, yeah, we do look at them. I mean, my goal is not to load people up with, you know, too many supplements, but definitely they can be very helpful.
Mm. Now, I know, Julie, you don't recommend a specific diet. You call yourself a diet synthesizer. What do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of people out there have, you know, kind of like with the weight loss diets, right? Everybody has their diet that they say is the best. And for a fraction of the people or a percentage of the people, it's definitely going to work. And so you hear, this is the diet. This is the best diet. It worked for me. But just like with those weight loss diets, autism diets are not one size fits all either. So while very frequently people start with gluten-free and casein-free and get very good results, it's not always the diet for everyone. And so sometimes it's the specific carbohydrate diet or the body ecology diet or another diet. So for me, I look at all the different diets, and I look at what symptoms someone's presenting and what foods they're eating and kind of what's going on with them, and then help choose a diet based on their individual needs and then customize a diet based on what other maybe negative food reactions they might be having.
Okay. Is there one diet that you find you use more than others?
Yes, I would say that the gluten and casein-free diet is the most popular and the one that I use most frequently.
Okay. There's one in here called the Feingold diet.
Yes.
I wonder if we could look at that a little.
Sure. So those salicylates, I didn't actually talk about them yet. The process of sulfation that I mentioned when you were asking me about the biochemistry,
yeah.
That process needs to happen in order to break down a food component called phenols. And phenols occur both in artificial ingredients, that's why we want to take all those artificial colors and flavors and everything out, as well as in certain naturally occurring fruits and vegetables like berries and bananas and grapes and apples and things like that. These are healthy foods, but it doesn't matter if they're organic or not, if you just don't have the right, you know, the biochemistry to process them, then they can have, you know, negative effects on the body. So the Feingold diet is a diet that specifically looks at these artificial and naturally occurring phenols and removes them for a period of time and then does a trial to add back in some of the fruits and see which ones the child has a negative response to and not. And I would just say one thing with that is that one of the ways we can't always determine this for certain, but one of the ways we get a sense of that is, you know, do they have any addictions? Like you said, the potato. So, for example, an example of this would be a child that only drinks apple juice and eats apples all day, you know, eats tons of apples or does that same thing with grapes or some food like that.
Mm. Does that have anything to do with fermented foods? You talk about fermented foods in the book.
So fermented foods are a separate category. Fermented foods, you know, I mentioned earlier we want to get out the bad stuff and add in the good stuff. The fermented foods are one of the good stuff. The most common fermented food we think of is yogurt. But if we want to be dairy-free, then we'll often use other types of fermented foods that you might not be as familiar with. So we make dairy-free versions of yogurt and something called kefir. We can do raw sauerkraut, or if children like that, some do, some don't. We can look at certain fermented beverages that are kind of fizzy and have some good kefir-type qualities and those sorts of things. So we look at the variety of different fermented foods because that good bacteria is so essential for the gut, for the immune system, for detoxification, that we want to get as much of that good bacteria in, especially after we've had lots of antibiotics.
Yeah, and you actually say there's a section here you talk about soaking and fermenting grains for increased digestibility for people who want to include grains in the diet. So tell us how you do that.
So if you think about any seed, anything in nature like a grain or a bean or a nut, they're all seeds, and they have special digestive inhibitors. So they're difficult to digest, and they're difficult to absorb the nutrients from them, and they add a burden to the system. So what we often do is soak them first, and that soaking mimics the germination process. It's a very simple thing to do. You soak it in water for 8 hours on the counter, you drain it off, you cook them. It's very easy, but nature does all the hard work over the 8 hours that it's soaking there, and it really helps to release a lot of those inhibitory compounds.
Oh, interesting. You talk in the book also about cleaning up the home, and we haven't really touched on environmental toxins very much. What do we need to be concerned about in the home?
Yes, any time we can take burden off detoxification for anybody, it's going to be helpful for their health, but especially for kids that don't detoxify very well. And so around the house, those are going to be things like any building materials, so carpets, new paint, rugs, maybe wall hangings and things, depending on what the fabrics are made out of, looking at the cleaners that you use around the house, making sure you're not using any pesticides around the house, looking at the cookware that you're using and avoiding things like aluminum and Teflon. So in my book, Nourishing Hope, I go into a lot of it's not just about food and nutrition because, you know, we live in the world with everybody else, and so there's also just good tips like that in the book on how to, you know, find good substitutes for all of those things.
Yeah, one of them, the Johnson's baby oil you've got right here made from petroleum products. And how much of that do we, well, we used to slather on. I think we're getting a little bit more advised about it now.
But. Right. Petroleum is one of those strong phenols that I mentioned earlier. So certain people have a much more difficult time than others with that.
Mm. I don't know if I saw this in your book or in some other information when I was doing research, but a lot of pets were found to have flame retardant substances in their bloodstream. And was that in your book?
I do talk about flame retardants. I don't talk about the pets, though. That's interesting.
Okay, yeah, they did some studies on pets in homes and found all kinds of horrible chemicals in them. So what do you say to parents? I've heard this, you know, parents blame themselves for their child's condition. How do you work with them to get over that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, that's, I think that's everybody's, if we all mastered that in life, we would all be, you know, it's something that we all struggle with, you know, how do we learn new information without feeling bad about the old place that we were at? And, you know, we don't know all the answers. We all are doing the best. The doctors are doing their best. The parents are doing their best. And the best thing that you can do right now is get educated, get some information, try these diets. If 65% of parents say that they get some benefit and sometimes significant benefit, it's an easy enough thing to try and see how it's going to work for your child. So I just really focus on the positive, that there is something that we can now do and that often makes a difference. And so let's just focus on what we can learn in this new area.
Yeah, and what do you say to somebody who says, because I can imagine this, you know, gosh, I have my hands full already. I'm working, I'm trying to take care of my autistic child, and now I have to manage, you know, everything they eat.
Right.
How do we simplify that down to, you know, the simplest form?
Sure. So believe it or not, once you get a new diet established, it's actually pretty easy to do it from there on out. And a lot of parents tell me that when they're giving advice to other new parents considering the diet, that, you know, their child is so much happier, so much better behaved, that they're not spending so much time chasing after them but enjoying their children, that that they can use some of that extra time and less stress they have in their life to have the capacity to do some of the cooking. So in the long run, it actually is much better for them.
Yes, I can see that would be. Of all the emerging research, Julie, what do you find most hopeful?
That's a good question. Well, one of the things I find most hopeful is just more and more doctors are finding out about this. So it's not necessarily a study that I'm thinking of, but just there are so many new doctors that are learning about this and understanding the importance of diet and applying these types of diets, that we're getting more and more good knowledge and more parents demanding good research in this area so we can help kids even more. I'd say that's probably one of the things I'm most encouraged by is that, and I have heard some interesting comments from some of the various pediatric organizations saying that they do understand that these artificial ingredients are harmful, and they do acknowledge that parents report benefits. So I do see the tides turning a little, and that's very encouraging.
Yeah, and I think we should point out that you didn't write this book just for parents. You wrote, I mean, this is a medical book, basically. You've written it for nutritionists and doctors who are not very familiar with the best ways to treat it nutritionally, correct?
I did. I wanted parents to be able to buy a copy of the book for themselves, pick up a copy of the book for their physician, so that they could both get on the same page with some common language. And I knew that because the mainstream doesn't have good things to say, because they haven't really looked at the research, I really wanted to synthesize the research down so that it really could be helpful for both groups. Because you know what? We need the physicians, and the physicians need educated parents to be on the same team. And so really we're trying to work together. And so I wanted the book to have simple things parents could do, but also explain the chemistry for maybe dad or their doctor or whoever it was they wanted to get on board with them.
Makes sense. And real quick, if a parent is looking for a nutritionist, what kind of questions do they need to ask right up front?
Well, I find out if they have any familiarity with autism diets, and particularly the gluten and casein-free diet or any others that they've done some research knowing they want to do, because there's only a small percentage of them that really understand the diets. Boy, that would be the first. That would be the first thing that I would ask about. Okay. Is their level of understanding in that area.
Okay, and I'm assuming they can always call you too.
And absolutely.
I want to make sure we're almost at the end of the show now, so I want to make sure we give out your book. It's Nourishing Hope: Nutrition Intervention for Autism Spectrum Disorder, and our listeners can find this book at nourishinghope.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Nourishinghope.com. Julie Matthews, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. You can catch more of this later on podcast if you missed any of it. Or you can check out our website at conversationslive.net. You can reach me at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617. Thanks for joining us today. Please join us next Monday at noon. Live well, live strong, and thanks for being with us.
How many times have you said, I'll never be able to do this, or I just can't do it anymore? Even the most creative of us run out of creative juice and fresh ideas. Well, get ready to get stimulated. And join Vicki St. Clair on Monday, April 28th at noon for Conversations Live, and explore 5 habits to launch you on an exciting journey of personal discovery. Learn how to build creative confidence and fire your creative energy. Vicki's joined by creative strategists, speakers, and authors Janine McGlade and Andrew Peck, co-creators of Noves Inc., a New York-based consulting and education firm that helps companies stimulate breakthrough ideas. That's Monday, April 28th at noon, with Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.